Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in the back of, we're in the back of Roberta's, we're in Bushwick. Kind of the back of Bushwick, too, though, right?
Pretty much.
Kind of like the butt end of
like
Bushwick?
Like the back of Williamsburg and the front of Bushwick.
Oh, really? You think this is the front end of Bushwick? I think people who actually live in Bushwick might disagree.
I don't know. I live here.
You live in industrial Bushwick or you live in Bushwick, Bushwick?
I live in Bushwick, Bushwick, like by the park.
Yeah, but, I mean...
This is like East... Industrial Williamsburg Park
stuff. Yeah. Well, Bushwick sounds a little more catchy than that, right? Bushwick. Joined as usual with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Yeah. Jack and Joe in the engineering booth.
Hey guys, how's the wine?
Great.
It's good. You want to tell us what you've given us to drink here?
I wish I could.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's some form of oxidized wine that Nastasha, by the way, here's something for all you people that she actually enjoys. She likes various varieties of oxidized wine products.
Hey, look at that.
I didn't even know. Like, are you a big sherry fan?
Not really. I think it has something to do with the color. I like the orange color. I like the weird taste.
That sounds like you. All right. So, listen, this is actually a real coincidence. I don't want people to think that... I'm shilling out for sponsors here because I had no idea Underground Meats was... is this the first time they're sponsoring us?
First or second. I think maybe once or twice before, but he was here recently. Cool dude.
Nice. Well, anyway, turns out the guys from Underground Meats in Madtown, as I guess they like to call it, the cheesehead folks. Have you ever hung out with people from Madison, Wisconsin?
I mean, just Johnny Hunter from Underground Meats.
But like, here's the thing about Madison, Wisconsin. I think I went once when I was a little kid because I used to go to Oshkosh for the fly-in, you know, with the EAA fly-in.
Yeah.
But people from Madison freaking love it. Like everyone that went to school up there, everyone they freaking love it. You ever meet someone from Madison who's like, "Yeah, man, Madison."
Everybody I know from Madison is obsessed with a card game called Sheep's Head.
Like Sheep's Head Bay, but not?
But not Sheep's Head Bay. It's a card game, and whenever Madison people get together, they play Sheep's Head.
What's it based on? Is it a trick-based game?
No, I can't even really describe it because I always lose because I don't know how to play because I'm not from Madison. So.
Does it involve cheese or beer?
Well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, back to what we were talking about. It turns out the Underground Meats, by the way, which is part of a larger thingamajig called the Underground Food Collective that's going on there in Madison, right? They have a Kickstarter, and I read about it. It's actually quite an interesting Kickstarter, so talk about it here. First, you want to search on go to Kickstarter.com or anywhere, I guess, the Google, search for Underground Meats and then Kickstarter, and you'll get it right away. And it's very interesting. Here's the thing. They have the right to sell their cured meats and charcuterie on a state level, right? They have Wisconsin state approval. But they want to get USDA approval so that they can sell across state lines, so they can get approved to sell across state lines. In order to do that, you need to have what's called validated HACCP plans. Now, for you guys that don't know what a HACCP plan is, HACCP stands for Hazard Analysis Critical Control Points. And it's the fundamental core. Oh, by the way, calling your questions, 2-718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Back to HACCP. So HACCP is it's the core of food safety in the United States and actually in other countries as well. And it was originally designed for the space program. At least this is my interpretation of it. You know, the space program, when they were doing that, they realized that, if an astronaut got food poisoned in space, it could have some serious, serious, serious consequences. So, you know, you don't want the astronauts to get the runs in space because how are you going to hold that stuff in? Just kidding. That's not really why. They just don't want them to be sick in space. So they wanted to have a zero tolerance policy on foodborne illness in space. And so they applied a lot of the same verification and checking techniques to the food that was going into the space program as was going into the individual components, the switches, the wires, you know, the materials that were in the spacecraft themselves. So large companies figured out a way to, in essence, as best you can, guarantee food safety. So big, big companies were involved in this program, ones like Pillsbury. It just became the overarching way that we do food safety in the U.S. And what it stands for is hazard analysis. You first have to analyze the hazards. And a hazard can be anything from maybe some person was picking fruit in a field somewhere and their ring fell off. And their ring fell off into – this has happened to me. Not while I was picking fruit, but while I was washing dishes once. Your ring falls off, and then it ends up in the basket of fruit and thing, and then it ends up in your equipment, and then somehow ends up in your food, and then you chew on the ring, and you know, lo and behold, you crack your tooth. Well, that's a hazard, right? So you've analyzed that hazard. And those hazards can be anything from things like actual foreign object damage, stuff like that, foreign objects, to deliberate adulteration by things like terrorists, which is why a lot of the HACCP also got a big boost in terms of traceability after 9/11. Destroying pathogens, to ensuring the cold chain. All of these things are analyzing where there can be possible hazards within the food chain, all the way from the where the raw ingredient was produced until the consumer puts it in their mouth. Right? Okay. Now, that's only the first part. You have to analyze the hazards, hazard analysis. Now you have what's called a critical control point. You say, okay, I know there's a hazard. You know, person might drop their ring into the basket of fruit that they're picking. Now you have to have a control point. Well, so how am I going to control to make sure that the ring doesn't make it into the apple pie? Well, let's say I put a metal detector at the front of the factory. When the apples come in, all the apples go through a metal detector, and if there's any metal, we make sure we take it out. That's a control point. Now, I guess they wanted a catchy thing, so they called it HACCP, because there's actually a third and very important part to HACCP, and that's verification. You have to have logbooks, and you have to be able to verify that you've checked and verify that your control points are adequately monitoring your products to ensure that they're safe. Hazard analysis, critical control point, and verification, right? HACCP. Now, you know, these are things that are done. For instance, modified HACCP plans, simple HACCP plans, are put in place all the time in restaurants, for instance, here in New York for sous vide cooking, but also it's used in a much more kind of screwed down, tightened down, buttoned down way industrially by everyone who's a commercial food producer. Now, the issue if you're going to get a USDA approval to do something like charcuterie is you need what's called a validated HACCP plan, right? And what a validated HACCP plan is not only that you've shown in theory that you have analyzed all the hazards and that you have chosen the correct critical control points and that you are verifying properly, you have to then prove it with an outside third-party source. And that costs money. Now, let me just show you something. There's an article, Jonathan Hunter from the Underground Food Collective did an interview on foodsafetynews.com about this Kickstarter they're doing. So what these guys are trying to do is they're trying to raise $40,000, right? If they raise the $40,000, they can hire the outside sources to do the microbiology and to do all the things to prove that the techniques that they're writing down for curing meats do in fact kill pathogens, right? Presumably they're gonna measure the salt content, the pH. I don't know if they're gonna measure water activity or what, but they're gonna verify that the techniques and tools that they use to verify safety for the salumi products that they're making, they're gonna verify that those things are in fact safe, and then they have to you pay someone to verify that for them. So here's a comment by someone named JT on the internet on the article on food safety, and I'm mentioning this because it's like classic people who make comments on the internet, presumably in their pajamas late at night while they're sipping on their last glass of wine before they hit the bed or while they're watching Jerry Springer, they think that they can make a comment that is useful. So here's what JT said, and I'm only saying this because I want people to know kind of where this kind of comment goes wrong so you don't think the same way. Because what these guys are doing, they're asking for $40,000. They're going to have their own validated HACCP plan. But then, I forgot to mention this. I should have said this right at the outset. What they're going to do is take this HACCP plan and then publish it so that anyone who uses the same procedures and same equipment can then use that same HACCP plan without having to shell out $40,000. They're trying to make an open source kind of validated HACCP plan. That's the concept. Okay, look. So JT writes in incorrectly, if you understand – this is about like why – like, I'll paraphrase JT. What do you need? What do you need 40 grand for a hazard plan to hire someone else to do a hazard plan for? That's how I imagine JT talks. Because, he says, if you understand your processes and how to make them safe and clean, then you should really be able to develop your own hazard plan based on the numerous guides and templates that already exist. See, already a lack of understanding. Yeah, you can have a template for a theoretical hazard plan, but you need a verified hazard plan for specific procedures, especially something like Salumi, where you're dealing with multifactorial barriers to killing bacteria and pathogens, like water activity, salt content, pH, all intertwined, and time, whatever. Anyway, so you should really be able to develop your own hazard plan based on the numerous guides and templates that already exist. If you need to hire a third party to develop your hazard plan, forget that you need to, because you need to prove it. Not only do you need to provide the actual scientific – you can go – anyone who cares to can go on the FSIS, which is whatever it is, Food Safety Inspection Services, whatever, website, and read what's required to get a validated HACCP plan, because it's right there on the thing. I know it's, the URL is too long to read, but they have it there. It's first you have to get your own scientific bolstering facts, right, from actual scientific literature. And if that doesn't exist, which thankfully it does in this case, but if that doesn't exist, you have to provide it. And then you have to do that and in practice prove that your specific techniques work. Anyway, so if you need to hire a third party to develop your HACCP plan, then you probably should not be in the business you're in, because that means you are highly ignorant about how to safely produce your products. Or, JT, you are highly ignorant about regulation. So please go check out their Kickstarter. And remember, if you enjoy the ability for small producers who cannot afford to have a validated HACCP plan, if you would enjoy to have more of those people around in our country making delicious products, or at least making products that they believe in, if you support people doing what they believe in, then you should go take a look at this Kickstarter. What do you think? Is that
good?
Yeah? Okay. Was he talking about that on the program, Jack?
Yeah, we did a short piece with him that I think will debut soon on the whole issue, breaking down HACCP and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I hope what I just said jives with what he said, because I kind of said it off the top of my head. But remember, you only got 22 days to donate to that Kickstarter, and they send you salami if you do.
Cool.
Anyways, okay, got some questions in. Now, Steven Benziger wrote in earlier, and he says that, hey, I asked you, called last week about transglutaminase and hydrocolloid polymerization resources to post, but I can't remember for the life of me what I said I was going to post. Can anyone remember what the heck I said I was going to post? Someone, like Steven, tweet into me and tell me exactly what I said I was going to post, and I'll make sure that I do it, because you got to remember, like, my mind totally, like, goes blank fritzes and runs away with me.
I listened to the show. I don't think there was any call-in.
You sure it wasn't from 2 weeks ago?
It was many weeks ago, because this email was lost, so it was many weeks ago.
No!
There were no calls last week.
Oh, Justino.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so Steven was also curious about some foods that he can circulate and refrigerate for long periods of time. Being a medical student, he says, I like to cook on hope to cook on weekends and reheat them before or at school. Thanks. Okay, well, there are a lot of products that you – in fact, like, one of the main benefits of now let's go sous vide in particular. Of sous vide cooking is you can pre-circulate a lot of your stuff and then just re-therm it. You remember, you can't – it's another one of the bizarre things. You can't say reheat, because reheat is a technical term. You can say it at home. It doesn't matter. But like in professionally, if you say reheat, you have to reheat it to a pathogen-killing temperature, whereas if you've pasteurized your product and kept it properly cold during the thing, then you only have to rethermalize it, which means you can heat up to any temperature you want. Okay. So – most things are possible to do this way. The only thing that you can't really do are things that you can't pasteurize. If you're gonna heat something in a bag, right? And when you're doing this, you're gonna keep something for a long time. It's advisable to actually vacuum bag it, because when you do things like Zippies, there's some oxygen on the inside. And if you're doing foods that have or that are prone to oxidation, like meats, especially meats tend to oxidize on reheating. It's called warmed over flavor. If you have a problem, products like that, it behooves you to get rid of the oxygen in there so that you don't have those sorts of issues on retherm, that you don't have kind of oxidized off flavors. Not dangers, just off flavors. So you probably want to invest in a vacuum bag in a situation like that. And you want to make sure, if you're going to keep stuff for a long time, that you pasteurize the products that you put in, right? Because if you don't pasteurize them, if you're just heating them to a point where you know, maybe you like the way they taste, but you've left bacteria, you could be put in a situation where you actually have incubated a certain portion of the bacteria and cause it to be less safe. Possible. I mean, not likely, but possible. So you want to choose things that you can pasteurize. What does that mean? Don't do fish. Most fish can't be adequately pasteurized in a vacuum bag because you're going to have to cook it for too high or for too long to get a good pasteurization such that you can safely cool it and then retherm it again later. Almost anything, if you pasteurize it properly, can be kept in your fridge for a week and then eaten later with no ill effects. Now, commercially, there is data that some people have gotten things to grow in vacuum bags you know, at temperatures between 38 Fahrenheit and 40 Fahrenheit, in that range. And so we actually have to keep, you know, if you're going to store stuff for a week commercially, at least in New York, I don't know if federally yet, because it's been a while since I've read this stuff, you actually have to keep your products below 40 degrees. I mean, it's been a while, but I think the number is somewhere like 38 or maybe even 34. I got to look it up. If you want to keep it for a full week, otherwise, you know, you have a shorter window to keep it. However, in the reality, if you do adequate pasteurization and you cool the stuff down rapidly enough, you know, you're not going to get in most real world situations any sort of bacterial growth on the inside of that bag within that 1 week. Within the Monday to Friday window. If you're cooking on a Saturday or Sunday and you're going to eat it before a Monday or a Friday, just make sure that you adequately pasteurize everything. That's all. Right, Sus?
Good job.
Yeah, she said it just so that I'll be quiet and move on. So I know you so well. She's like, will you just be quiet about the safety stuff? Stas like, Stas doesn't care. Stas, well, you care about safety somewhat.
I do. Yeah.
Not my safety.
No.
All right. And with that, why don't we take our first commercial break? Coming back with cooking issues.
Underground Meats is an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. They use small farms from southwest Wisconsin to source their meat. The animals are raised on pasture for their entire lives by farmers who care about animal welfare. While Underground Meats uses European traditions, they also use ingredients from the upper Midwest to try to create new types of salamis, experimenting with both ingredients and techniques. The salamis are made using heritage breeds, mostly red wattles, tamworths, berkshires, and mule foots. Try their award-winning cured pork shoulder and goat salami. To learn more and purchase products, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin.
And welcome back! What's up, Sus?
I thought they were
going to
do another commercial.
Nope, they're not. It's just us. Nice, right? Okay. Although we don't mind the commercials. We like commercials, kind of, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Lucas writes in, who we met. Pretty sure it's the same Lucas that we met at the well, I first met him at the Kickstarter launch party, and then at the Puffing Gun party that we had, which was a good party.
Yeah.
Good party.
That was good.
Good party. Okay, I believe this is the same Lucas, although I'm not sure. Hi, Dave, Anastasia, Jack, and Joe. I went to El Calarcan Roca, which, by the way, you know, was named, was it last year or a couple years ago, like the best restaurant in the world? Like, you know, it's the Roca family.
By who?
What?
Like, who said it was the best?
It's one of those Pellegrinos. You know, I hate, first of all, like, if we say this again, I'll say this again, although, you know, if you've met me, you've heard me say this a million times. The idea of the best restaurants, the most ridiculous thing in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, there actually, that's not true. There are more ridiculous things. Like, you know, I don't know, like the Syrian government didn't do that chemical attack. That's more ridiculous. But, like best restaurant is just a silly concept. Because mm-hmm. What does that mean? Do you want to go out to, you know, a 3-Michelin-star meal every night? No. Hell no, right? So, like, it's like the best restaurant on any particular night. I mean, I don't know. It's like – but that said, it's one of the restaurants in the world, one of the, you know, I would say top 3 restaurants in the world that I want to go to that I haven't been to.
Okay.
Hey, guys. Piper's on the line.
Oh, Piper? All right. Well, let me make him hold. Boom. Boom. Oh, yeah. All right, now we'll take Piper now. We'll come back to El Clark and Rogan. Man, I just wanted to be – hey, Piper.
Hey, Dave.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
So we had a question a couple weeks ago, and I promised that I would get you on the line to talk about it. And it has to do with puddings. And I know that you're a pudding head. And so by the way, Piper works with us at Booker & Dax Equipment Corporation and worked for a while doing research, food research, technical stuff for CP Kelco, the manufacturers of such fine products as Gelan and a lot of the high-grade pectins that you buy. And they also make – what else do they make? Like clear locust bean – what do they make? Clear locust bean gum?
They do carrageenans and xanthan gum.
Yeah.
And they have locust bean gum, yeah.
Well, they need the clear locust bean gum so that they can make their fake gelatin stuff with carrageenan. Because everyone, if you want to do a vegetarian fake gelatin, like one of the classic ones is a mixture of mostly kappa carrageenan and locust bean gum to kind of soften the texture of a little bit so it's not so brittle. But if you want to replace gelatin, it has to be fairly clear. So regular locust bean gum, which is cloudy, doesn't make a good gelatin replacer. So CP Kelco has to make this expensive clear locust bean gum. Would you say it's accurate?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, I forget who it was, but a gentleman called in a couple weeks ago and said he was having problems with the texture of his puddings, and he was doing kind of classic cornstarch-based puddings. And I knew that you would be making the Piper version of the Nastasha vegan face for not using some sort of better pudding technology. So and I said I would find out what Piper's favorite pudding technology is, so go.
Well, I mean, it really depends on what he has at hand. Just had cornstarch, you know. What I like to do is an iota heavy iota kappa carrageenan blend. Sorry, iota kappa and locust bean blend. So, like, depending on firmness, like 0.3 iota, 0.1 kappa, and then 0.05 locust bean gum just for synergesis.
All right, hold on a second. So you said point what on the iota?
I like to do about 0.3.
Right. Now, have you had any experience with the readily available carrageenan blends? Because something people don't really understand in general is that hydrocolloids, like carrageenans are gotten from seaweeds. And all of the carrageenans are from the similar varieties of seaweeds. But there's no such thing as pure kappa or pure iota or pure lambda carrageenan. Carrageenans, because they're the result of refining and purifying a natural seaweed product, are all kind of shotgun mixtures. And each manufacturer standardizes a particular carrageenan blend for a particular application. So one iota is not the same as another iota. One kappa is not the same as another kappa, right? They might have a different blend of carrageenans. They might have hydrocolloids come in differing polymerization lengths, how long the actual polysaccharides are that are in them, and so they have different ranges. But if you found that like the various iotas that are available for people to purchase are roughly similar in their action here, or do you have a particular brand that you like to use that is available to humans?
The texture is pretty close to the most pure blends that I've been using from CP Kelco.
Okay, so you use their iota and their kappa. And you say it works fine, their iota and their kappa. All right.
And Terra works good, too.
Terra Spices, iota, and kappa work fine? Okay. So give those give those percentages one more time.
This is for, like, a creme brulee.
Right.
Sort of texture. It's 0.3% iota, 0.1% kappa, and then 0.05 locust bean gum.
Okay. Now, folks, just so you know, locust bean gum has to be heated above what? About, well, all of those things have to be heated about above like 75°C or something like that, right?
Yeah. I don't mind taking it to like 80.
Yeah. But then, so if you're going to add something that would otherwise not work well at those temperatures, proteins, eggs, stuff like that, you would prehydrate that stuff and then temper it back in, right? Because locust bean gum is never going to set, and the carrageenans aren't going to set until it gets down into the probably like the 130s Fahrenheit, 120s Fahrenheit, right?
Yeah, and then, I mean, if you've got cornstarch, you can also, you can put that in, and that would sort of soften the gel up a little bit. It would interrupt the structure.
Right. Well, that's also why, Wiley cornstarches his egg yolks to stop them from setting in his in his hollandaise sauce. But I believe that's what he does. I believe he probably uses something more sophisticated, but that'll also stop. That'll also buffer the proteins a bit if you add them to the proteins first, right?
Yeah, I mean it'll do a couple of things. I mean it'll also stop up some of your thinner eats. It's not amazingly well, but what I like to do is do about 10% or maybe like 12% sugar. Dry blend all my hydrocolloids with that. Disperse in 50-50 cream and milk, and then beat that to roughly 85, and then put it in the blender and add about 2 egg yolks per 250 milliliters of liquid, and then I add that at about as it's cooling down. Right. It just helps speed things up, and then I just pour it into a setting pan.
All right. So now to translate some of the things that Piper just said, he dry blends the hydrocolloids with sugar. Why? Because the main problem with using hydrocolloids, there's two things you need to do with a hydrocolloid. Hydrocolloids swell and clump. So if you want them to work, you have to prevent that. So dry blending with sugar helps to physically separate the particles of the hydrocolloids so that they can be dispersed, right? After he disperses them, he hydrates them by heating, right? And then hydrates them in the closest thing to pure water he has in this case, which is milk and whatever else he's going to do. And then afterwards, as it's cooling in the blender under high shear, adds things like egg yolks and then allows the product to set. Now, if you break down what he's using for the actual hydrocolloid base here, he's using iodocarrageenan. And by the way, carrageenan, one of the main things about carrageenan that's awesome is it has a synergistic effect with milk, meaning it takes a very, very small amount of carrageenan to set milk. And the advantage of that is that the smaller amount of a hydrocolloid you use to create a gel, the less masking you have of flavor. Well, it's cheaper also, but for most people at home, that's not really a concern because the amounts you're using are so small. But also, there's a lot less flavor masking if you're using much smaller amounts of hydrocolloids. So iota carrageenan is a kind of rubbery, if you use a lot of it, kind of rubbery and kind of bouncy textured stuff. Blowing kind of texture. It has an interesting properties. Unlike most other hydrocolloids, it will reform a gel after it has been sheared, which is interesting, right? But it's the soft one. Kappa is brittle, more like agar. It snaps when you break it in half. So he's doing a mix between iota and kappa to get the kind of texture he wants. And then he's adding locust bean gum. The locust bean gum is going to do two things. It's going to soften the kappa a bit, right? And it's also going to stabilize any of the water that's not locked into the carrageenan gel matrix and prevent that water from weeping out. That's when he's saying synaresis. So when you have locust bean gum that you're adding, locust bean gum is preventing the weeping or the synaresis that you often get in gel systems or even in regular pudding systems if you consider them a gel system. And in fact, that is why you have in most ice creams two stabilizers. It's not that they want to jack everything up, but they have one that's doing a mild gelling, right, to prevent crystallization, something like carrageenan. And then you have something to prevent what's called way off or synaresis, even at low temperature, of liquids out of the matrix of the ice cream. And that is something like a locust bean gum or a guar. Yes or no?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And also, insist that people use non-baker's percentages because it would throw off the recipe.
You say it again?
They shouldn't use the baker's percentages. It's like absolute percentages.
You're talking about when you say, Piper, because he worked for CP Coco, writes a recipe and he says a percent, he means that there is 1 gram of hydrocolloid in 99 grams of water, and that's 1%. Yeah, but you're talking less than a percent on everything. It's going to be minimal for these.
Well, I mean, it's going to be minimal, plus you've got 10 to 12% sugar. It makes a difference.
With the sugar, it does. Not with the hydrocolloid, though.
But the sugar is as a percentage of the whole. Your liquid portion is smaller. I don't know. I'm sorry.
But okay. So what you're saying is they should figure out what their total weight of their batch is and then do your hydrocolloids based on that.
Yeah.
Because you haven't calculated a liquid basis only.
Yeah.
Well, we should calculate a liquid basis on it because no one does that, you know? No one I mean, whenever I write a hydrocolloid recipe, I always try to write the numbers based on percent of water and then try to ignore the sugar stuff. But it's a really – it's a complicated thing. It's a problem. The fact of the matter is if you find a recipe that you like that works, as long as you are consistent in applying that recipe, you're going to be okay. Piper's method, which is the actual method you use in business, in industry, commercially – is better because if you think about the hydrocolloid to liquid base as being – or the hydrocolloid to total base and how the sugar interacts with it, it's going to make it easier for you to make a second and third recipe that don't contain sugar, right? That's the that's what you're saying. But it makes it more difficult for someone at home to figure out the recipe in general. Would you say that's accurate, Piper, or no?
That's true. It also makes it easier for scaling.
What?
And
your,
for testing.
Your technique?
Yeah, my technique.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that must be a reason why everyone does it in the real world. But chefs just don't like it. They don't do it, you know? Anyway.
Yeah.
All right, Pipes. Thanks for calling in. I'll see you in a little bit.
Yep, later.
All right. So back to Lucas's problem. I went to El Calar Can Roca a couple of months ago and really enjoyed it. The problem is that this place is in Spain and not exactly a budget meal. That's true. I hear it's quite expensive. Anyway. One of the most impressive things I had there was an oyster with a venison mayo. It was an intense experience. I'm trying to reproduce it, but I have no idea how to infuse so much flavor into the mayo. I can make quite a strong stock with a pressure cooking using multiple extraction. Typically, once you make mayo, you do not add much of any additional liquid. What happens is either I end up with not a very flavorful product or I break the mayo. Do you think that they somehow infuse the oil directly or do they make some ultra flavorful stock? I'm trying with duck rather than venison as I don't have venison, but I guess this is not an issue. Regards, Lucas. Okay. I have some guesses as how you do it. There's a couple of ways you can do this. One, you could the simplest way, the kind of the most bonehead simple way, is to make a fluid gel, like a gelan-based fluid gel, out of the stock. I know a stock already has gelatin in it, but you make a fluid gel, right? And then you can mix the fluid gel into the mayonnaise without breaking the mayonnaise because you're not actually adding a liquid to it. You're adding a second solid that has the same consistency as the mayonnaise itself. So it shouldn't dork with the emulsion too much, right? So you're going to have a mayonnaise and then you're going to fold into the mayonnaise something with the exact same texture as the mayonnaise but just a fluid gel, okay? Now, that's one. Now, the more high-tech way to do it, okay, and if you were going to do the fluid gel and you're going to do a mayonnaise, I'd say with gelatin, you could do an agar fluid gel, actually. Agar fluid gel would be easier to achieve in terms of stuff you could go out and buy at a store. If you're going to do an agar fluid gel, it would probably be on the order of 0.9% agar. But agar and gelatin can cause problems sometimes. I have to look at it, but gelatin should work. But the real baller way to do it would be to take your venison stock, right, and then get an enzyme. And Stas, we got to find a source of this enzyme. It was one of my favorite enzymes of all time to use. It's called Corallase. So Corallase is an enzyme that breaks down gelatin. The problem with using, let's say, a meat tenderizer like papain or one of these other things that you can buy, meat tenderizer enzymes break down proteins, but they can often break down the proteins into bitter polypeptides, okay? And also, I've tested it. They're not as effective as you would like in totally breaking all the gelatin down, as you want for the application I'm about to tell you. This enzyme, Corallase, which breaks down gelatin, is specifically chosen because when it breaks down gelatin, it does it in a way that does not create any off flavors at all. It creates only completely soluble, non-viscous, and tasteless polypeptides, right? So, and this stuff is a miracle. You could take if it's cold, it takes a little longer for it to work, but you could take jellied stock, drip a couple of drops of Corallase into it, and it completely melts the stock down to nothing. So it has no more body in it, right? Once you destroy the gelatin, you can take that stock. You could take 2 liters of stock and reduce it down to 100 milliliters. And it still will not set. You have to worry about not scorching because it has an incredibly high solids level just from the the solids in it, but not gelatin. And so it allows you to get ridiculous reductions on that stuff, and then you can incorporate that as a liquid base into mayonnaise without having interfering effects from setting gelatin or any of these other problems, or having to add too much, it's going to break it. And that's the way, you know, when I had Coralace, when I had some of it, that's the way we would do like super strong beef flavored drinks. We would break very, very concentrated, cold consommés that were liquid by breaking the gelatin and then hyper reducing it. And then that, you know, you could then probably get a lot of flavor into a mayonnaise without having to resort to something like a fluid gel. But if you want to go out and do it tonight, I would go out and make a gelan fluid gel with your venison stock. You know, first reduce it, make a gelan fluid gel, blend it, and then fold it in. That should work. What do you think, Seth?
Good job.
Yeah. Again, she's like, I don't care. Just if he asks me, just tell him to stop talking.
Hey, right? Dave.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of people kind of tweeting and writing us about 3D printers and asking us to cover that. What do you know about 3D printers and food?
Us meaning us, or us meaning the greater us?
The greater us, the station.
Well, that's an interesting question. So the 3D printing of food is something, you know, we were a number of years ago, we were, you know, dealing with Cornell with the Fab at Home, which is an extruder,
they
right?
They were on Rachel Ray.
They were on the Rachel Ray program, and we had to run over some syringes because their syringes didn't come through. We still had some syringes left over, so we brought them over. But and Piper and Nastasha wanted to get into the studio audience.
We wanted to win a cruise.
Did anyone that day win a cruise?
We never saw the show.
So you didn't even look to see whether or not you didn't win a cruise? So you're upset about a cruise that you may or may not have won?
Yeah.
What? You don't want to know?
I don't want to know. No.
You don't want to you wait, you don't want to know about the
cruise.
Because
I would have fought harder.
You take the you're like, okay, here's a question before we get into the printing. So like the question, if you could take a genetic test to know whether or not you're more likely to get a specific disease or not, right? Would you take it? Answer yes, because then you can prevent or do something. So you want to know like your possible future genetically,
yeah.
But you don't want to know whether or not the cruise was an actual issue?
I would have fought harder. Like, I paid for this genetic testing. I paid, you know, like, I'm doing everything I can. I didn't do everything I could for the Rachel Ray Show possible cruise. So I don't want to know if I could have won.
Because you don't want to know that, like, possible personal weakness caused you to not get a cruise.
Right.
Fair.
Thank you.
Fair. So back to 3D printing. So we were getting this 3D printer to work with. And, you know, the goal, people have this thing in their heads. And there was a New York Times article on it very recently on printing 3D food. And the goal out there is that somehow, you know, you're going to print your table, and then you're going to print your plate, and then you're going to print your food. And then you're just going to sit down, and someone's going to email you this awesome recipe, and it's going to print out, like, along with everything. And I've never been a fan of this idea, ever. I've always thought it was kind of, you know, not what I think cooking is about, and not what I think food is about. I think the idea of 3D printing architectural units is very interesting because it allows you to do things you couldn't otherwise do. The idea of 3D – and we use 3D printers when we're designing equipment. At Booker & Dax Equipment Corporation, we use 3D printers and we use 3D printing sources to do rapid prototypes. But food isn't about – prototyping or about, you know, short runs of something like a facade for an architectural building that you can then create out of concrete with a 3D printer in a way you couldn't otherwise do. Food is about the day in, day out creation of something that that you want to eat. And in general, like the 3D food technology that's out there right now is all about extruding paste and then setting that paste into something else. And there's only so far you can go with the extrusion of different types of paste. I mean, it's hard to get all the different textures you want, hard to get all the different flavors you want. I mean, if someday they could, you know, scan a steak and then reproduce it exactly, then I don't know, maybe. But it's just not what I think about when I think of food. I like to think about my food being produced. I like to think about it growing or being raised. I like to think about how it's harvested, how it's treated. And none of these things as yet are reducible to pushing a button and printing it out. And like not even close. I'm not saying that that won't happen someday, but it's not even in the realm. It's not even in the sphere of what's going on right now. Literally, what's going on right now is paste is being extruded out of tubes into shapes. So it's like, hey, look, the applications, the brain dead. What you need applications? Do you want your scallop paste to look like Mickey Mouse or a space shuttle, or do you want, like, you know, your boyfriend's head, you know, in hot dog meat? If you want your boyfriend's head in hot dog meat, either to chop it to pieces with a samurai sword or to, you know, lovingly munch on it, then 3D printing, fantastic. You know what I mean? Because it is great at reconstructing your boyfriend's head out of hot dog meat. Fantastic at it. There's no better way, because unless you're going to hire an artist to make a sculpture, or unless you're going to mold your boyfriend's head and then jam hot dog meat into it to make a boyfriend hot dog head, you know. And by the way, you know, that's assuming that you can stand a skinless wiener, because, you know, I prefer Frankfurter with a real skin on it. You know what I'm saying? Stas is making some weird faces now. But the because her mind works in gross ways.
Boyfriend hot dog head face.
Yeah.
The new one, right?
Yeah, exactly. A wiener. Oh, wiener face. Oh, jeez. So the by the way, like that.
Hey, I wish you could put this out there for everyone to know, because I'm so sick of you getting these questions about 3D printing. Like we're gonna eat some phenomenal food out of a 3D printer,
which we're not.
It's paste. It's paste. It's paste.
Wow, I love Nastasha finally coming out on something.
Like the first time in 3 years, I think.
So, we've been doing this, you know, for 4 years, I think now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And nobody has said that it's paste.
It's paste.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paste. And so, like, here's the thing. Here's the thing, right? So we did come up with one thing we liked, which was, you know, what is a novel thing you can do with a 3D printer with paste that is hard to otherwise do? And it was this idea that, you know, Lipton came up with a stochastic printing, where it's basically where you hold the toothpaste tube. It's not a toothpaste tube, but you hold the syringe up high and you let it form a squiggle, almost like Velcro, and you get these kind of masa squiggles that, you know, are, you know, that have, they're good because you could fry them, and the texture is different from what you would ordinarily get with masa. Right. And so I always said that from the very get go. I was like, I don't really want to use it unless there's some sort of new texture we can produce, or new flavor we can produce with paste. But another interesting fact, someone tweeted in maybe it was a couple weeks ago about this. You ever heard of this Beyond Eggs thing?
No.
Mm-mm. So there's this product out there, and it was funded in part by Gates. It's some kind of Silicon Valley thing where it's a completely non-egg egg. It's all plant-based. And it fooled Bill Gates it's just as good as a real egg, because it fooled Bill Gates. Now, I need to try this myself. Please, someone from California, if you can find a Whole Foods thing, we love at Booker and Dax to have a sample of Beyond Eggs to see whether or not it's just that Bill Gates has horrible taste buds for eggs, or whether or not they were just overcooked or whatever. But apparently, Stas, you can make scrambled eggs out of these. It tastes like the real legit deal.
Since when's Bill Gates like the standard by which we judge these things? That's crazy.
Well, because he's got the money to back it up.
I see.
I guess that's why. Oh, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a sort of a two-part question about live poultry markets. I recently bought a chicken at a live poultry market. It was a label roost chicken, so I think it was, by the standards, it's supposed to be somewhat older than the normal commercial breed. And I was just curious if there's just a different approach to dealing with live poultry. I'll tell you what I did with it. It was just a standard chicken roasting technique. But I, after buying it, I salted it, and then I had read on the Turkey Post on cooking issues of the rigor mortis. So I think I let it sit for about 24 hours in the fridge after it had been fairly heavily salted. And then I used the low temperature roasting at about 150 for about, you know, 2.5 hours to bring it up to about 135, and then finished it in a hot oven after resting to crisp it up. I think the texture was actually a lot chewier than I expected, and I didn't know if this was related to the age of the chicken or cooking techniques with something that's been that recently killed, or if you have any thoughts here on the approach.
Well, old chickens, I mean, if it actually is old, like old chickens, they taste better, but they are never going to be as tender as a young chicken. you know, never. And, you know, so that's like, you know, when you go to, you know, other countries that, you know, as their standard chicken and things like stews and whatnot have older older birds, they're just not tender. And you just have to, like, kind of get past the American ideal that chicken is supposed to be tender. Now, that said, before you cooked it, did you grab the legs and move them around? Had they loosened up? Had they limbered?
You know, I cut off the legs right when I got it home. So, the feet. Sorry, they didn't feel, but the legs, they didn't feel any different than I'm used to. And most of the poultry I buy is in Chinatown markets that presumably is, you know, somewhat more recently killed than stuff you have in the supermarket. But I'm not, you know, it didn't feel any different to me in that respect.
Right. I mean, I've purchased poultry at the live market and then let it rest overnight and had it be tough as nails, right, on things like duck. But I think a lot was the, you know, also the breed of duck that I was getting. And, you know, the main reason I go to live poultry now isn't for chickens, because I'll just get that. There are, you know, suppliers that I like and trust that have good chickens, but I'll go for the turkeys. Especially before I had the good contacts here at Heritage Foods, I would go for the turkeys to get them, and I would let them rest a couple of days probably. Although, you know, supposedly overnight, but like, you know, I think it's probably a combination. I think maybe you could have gone a little bit longer. I also don't know, and this is an interesting question, I don't know the effects of salting during rigor as opposed to salting after rigor. I don't know. I have no idea. Like, literally, I have no concept of.
Well, this place has a buy 10 chickens, get one free, so it sort of encourages you to do these sort of side-by-side experiments. The second question is just related to the killing method. I was also reading about the Ikijime, and I was just wondering, has anyone done this sort of flesh comparison with different chicken killing methods? I should back up to say, too, I'm just looking at a Wikipedia entry for Mike the Headless Chicken, and it was this chicken that in the 40s was decapitated but somehow survived for years. So it was reminding me of reading about Ikijime and wondering if, you know, there's a comparative study of killing methods on poultry.
There's not, to my knowledge. I am familiar with Mike the Headless Chicken, which, interesting story. The guy chopped the head, thought he chopped the head off of the chicken, let it run around like a chicken with its head cut off, and then came back and the sucker was still moving like a long time later. And then it turns out that he had left a certain portion of the brainstem in, and he would feed Mike by shoving grain into its, you know, into its like open throat hole. And the sucker lived for a while, Mike the Headless Chicken. So that what started as an incompetent slaughter made this farmer like a good chunk of change. You can go, but you know what's disappointing about Mike the Headless Chicken is that there's no really, really good photos of Mike the Headless Chicken, right? You notice that? It's like there's some, but there's nothing, like no close-ups of where the head used to, whatever.
Anyway. Yeah, it's hard to tell from the photo where, how exactly it was decapitated.
Yeah, I think the guy hit it at an angle because, like, you can see it's like a little bit higher up in the back, and like that's what allowed the portion of the brainstem that controls kind of the heart regulation and peristalsis in the system to keep going. But back to the actual question, I don't think that the studies have been done on that. It's been a long time since I've read up on poultry slaughter. Most of the data out there on most animals shows that pre-slaughter stress is bad for meat quality. But I've read more stuff on, you know, obviously in pork, it's a huge issue with pig slaughter and cows. And I've obviously done a lot of work with fish on that. But the specific reasons why fish tastes or has a better texture as a result of the specialized killing techniques is because hard rigor in a fish leads to mushy fillets and to bad texture, especially for sushi, sashimi applications. So I don't know, I don't know what the effects are of, for instance, preserving the ATP reserves of chicken muscle. Now, you know, aside from that, you know, there's probably all sorts of, you know, awful things that get injected into a chicken system if it's freaked out right before it gets slaughtered, right? So there's certain things going on. And, you know, for a number of years, I have had in my head different tests to be able to do on this, but it gets dicey. When you're doing slaughter tests on fish, people don't seem to mind. As soon as you move to higher creatures like perceived higher creatures like birds, or even, you know, God forbid, into the range of mammals that are eaten for food, people look at any sort of experiments like that as being somehow like horrible, when in fact you're just trying to make it more humane. You're just trying to do better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think the certified humane stuff that they sell in supermarkets, they knock them out first. I didn't have time to look it up extensively, but you know, that would definitely be different from a live poultry market where I think they're bleeding it out through the neck, which, you know, not chopping its head off.
Well, I mean, every time I've been to the live poultry market, what they do is they take especially big birds, they tie them by the feet and let them hang upside down alive, flapping, freaked out to figure out how much they weigh. Then they take the bird, you know, put it down, chop its head off, and go. I mean, that's pretty much how – and I think that's pretty much, you know, the de rigueur method of doing it. Like, and so, yeah, they're not doing any I mean, at least the places that I've been, I didn't see any electro-stunning equipment. Let's put it that way. You know, whereas I think it probably commercially electro-stunning is the way to go on chicken slaughter. Did you see any electro-stunning where you were? I don't think that they do that at the live poultry joints.
No, this place, I think it was – I got the head on too, so it was Chinese style. But I think they do all – much of their business is halal, so I don't know the details of halal slaughter, but it seemed to be that a lot of their meat was default halal, unless, you know, you had some special method, just because so much of their customer base were people seeking halal meat.
Right.
So that would, and I think that is bleeding it out to the neck. So, which sounds especially cruel now that I think about it.
Well, yeah. So if halal, I mean, I've never done as much as I should research on halal techniques, but if my memory serves, kosher slaughter techniques would dictate that the animal is conscious, right, to prove that it's all intact and everything, and then humanely slaughtered with a quick slice to the throat, which would mean that there is no stunning involved, because that would compromise the animal prior to the slaughter. So my guess would be that, yeah, there's no form of stunning involved there.
Yeah, and then finally, I was just with Chinese dishes, when you see fresh killed chicken, and I think some Korean restaurants are, you know, they're advertising this too. Do you think that is pre-rigor flesh that they can actually? Because apparently the place that I went to, which is in Bensonhurst, supplies one of the places in Midtown. But I was thinking that, you know, it's within several hours, right? So you is that texture actually a chicken in rigor, or is it pre-rigor, or do you have any idea?
No, I mean, but that'd be super interesting, right? Just get the chicken, rush home and cook it right away. The interesting one would be to go in the morning, get a chicken, right, put it in your fridge, go in the evening, get the chicken, rush home, and then do one maybe the day before, 2 days before, and then like cook them all three at the same time, side by side in the same oven, and test them out. That'd be fascinating.
I might try that, because now I'm curious, especially with the salting as well, because there's some way that I feel like the texture might change pretty radically by, you know, different times and different salting, just in that, you know, 12 to 48 hours if you did 12-hour intervals.
Yeah, well, if you do it, please, you know, write into us, or, you know, let us know what's going on, because this is the kind of information that we crave.
Okay, yeah, I'll certainly do it. I'll let you know.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
Bye. Peter Cook wrote in, at Cooking Issues, what are your favorite uses for fish sauce, and are there any good substitutes for alcohol when deglazing and or flavoring? I like fish sauce in almost everything. Stas, you a fish sauce fan?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I love myself some fish sauce. I mean, let's say you have someone – it's just delicious. I mean, soups, delicious with fish sauce. I don't mean – It's one of those things that I would add to many things. Like, let's say someone doesn't eat meat, but they eat fish, right? Fish sauce. I put fish sauce in everything. I also like anchovies a lot. I will throw anchovies into almost anything. I really like salty, fish-flavored things. So it's like hard for me to say, you know, it's hard for me to say what my favorite is because I just like them so much. Now, what I would recommend you do with fish sauce is there's no such thing as one fish sauce. Like my favorite brand that you can get kind of around is Tiporos. I like that one a lot. I think that one's from Thailand. But go out and source yourself some like really interesting fish sauces, like Ishiri from Japan. It's not really fish sauce, but go get some Colatura anyway from Italy. That's good. You like that stuff? Like yeah, the anchovy yeah. juice? Yeah, it's good. So, I don't know. Now, any good substitutes for alcohol when deglazing and or flavoring? Now, nothing adds alcohol flavor quite like alcohol does. But for deglazing, really, you don't have to use alcohol. In fact, a lot of times, the only real thing you need to have for a deglazing liquid is that it can't have so many solids in it that it scorches on the pan. You're using it to break the solids off the pan and then reduce. So anything that's flavorful that's not going to scorch during the time that you're deglazing, you can use. And often you're deglazing with with water, or you know, if you're making gravy or something else. But the reason you add the alcohol first when you deglaze is so that you have more opportunity to cook the alcohol out before you add the bulk of your liquid. I mean, I think that's the reason why people add alcohol first when they're deglazing, not because it needs to be alcoholic. In other words, I don't think they're using the properties of the alcohol to dissolve the stuff on the bottom of the pan. If that makes sense, does that make sense to us? Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a great name because I can't pronounce it. It's G with O with an O umlaut R-A-N. So I'm going to call it Gurin, Eldon, Gurin. What do you think? Yeah. Gurin. I'm going to go with Gurin. At cooking issues, I often use canola oil for frying. Good or bad? Many people use a lot of olive oil. Isn't that a bad choice for hot applications? All right, Gurin, here's the deal. Olive oil is not bad for hot applications. However, you aren't getting any awesome taste benefit if you heat the olive oil too much. And we talked about this a while, I think maybe like a year ago or 6 months ago, where we did a bunch. Someone called in and we talked to McGee about it. We did some side-by-side taste tests of eggs cooked in olive oil. And Mark Ladner was here that day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we were tasting eggs. Remember? We're tasting eggs. And it turns out that it's fine. Cooking with olive oil is fine, but you know all the awesome fruity notes and kind of the varietal characteristics and all the things you love about the taste of olive oil are wiped out by the cooking. It's not bad from a technical standpoint. Now, So that's that. Now, the other problem is that a lot of olive oils will degrade quickly if you're frying, and so they're not a good choice for frying long-term or if you're frying a lot of stuff or if you're going to have a lot of particles sitting around in it because depending on which kind you get and what's going on, the smoke point can lower faster than some other oils. All right? Now, as for whether canola oil is good or bad, I used to hate canola oil, hated it, like in the 90s. Like I hated it so much because the stuff that you would buy that was cheap just hadn't been properly deodorized, and so it tasted wretched, awful. But the canola oils that I've tried recently, and it took me many years to after I had done some initial frying tests with canola oil in the 90s, it took me many years. I'm talking early 90s too, like 92, 93. It took me many years to go try canola oil. In fact, for a decade or so, I was like, hell with canola oil, crap on it. I don't care. It could be the healthiest thing on earth. It could save my life. I'm not going to use it for frying. And then I tried it again, sometime in the 2000s, and I think they fixed that problem. The average deodorization of the canola oil is fine. Now, canola oil, canola is not a plant. Canola is a contraction, I think, of Canada and oil because it was originally developed up there from a variety of rapeseed. Talk about a crap name for a product. Rapeseed is from the mustard family, and so they developed a variety of rapeseed that was particularly low in I don't even know how to pronounce it, but like erucic or the stuff that the unsaturated fatty acid that's in mustard oil, which if you have it in large quantities, some people say it's bad for you, which is why you can't get the real deal mustard oil here in the U.S. easily unless it's labeled not for consumption, even though the studies are crap. So anyway, so people are worried about that, but the canola oil that's out there has very low, less than 2% of that fatty acid in it, and so there's nothing out there that shows that that is a health problem. There's some studies, I couldn't read them because my internet was crapping out on me, that certain trans PUFAs, That's awesome. Transpufa, polyunsaturated fatty acids. Transpufas are formed during the deodorization process. That I can't attest to because, unfortunately, I couldn't get to the data with my internet this morning. But I don't have anything out there that says that that I believe, that I trust, that says that the stuff is bad for you in any sense. And I know a lot of people say it's good for you. I don't believe that either. But I can say that I no longer believe that it tastes like crap, and it's probably good for frying because I believe the smoke point is fairly high. On the way out, because they're going to kick me out of here, I forgot last week to give a shout out to Mei Mei in Boston, Mei Mei Food Truck, and I guess I don't know whether the kitchen, the non-food truck thing is open yet, but they came to the talk that we gave. You know, the whole crew came to the talk that we gave with McGee, and then you know, I wanted to spend some time with them afterwards talking to them, and you know, I set off the freaking fire alarm, and so we got cleared out of the building, and you guys gave me a set of pastries. You said this is the best pastry in all of Boston, and it got lost in the shuffle, so I didn't eat the pastry. It's horrible, but I did get from those guys two bottles of liquor from Boston, and I really appreciate bringing kind of Boston, you know, Boston local products for me to taste when I'm in Boston, or in Cambridge in this case. Although you didn't bring any of your own stuff, so next time I go up there, I want to try your own stuff. But they did bring two things: Grand 10, which is in Boston distilling, Grand 10 distilling, Angelica liqueur, which is like an Angelica liqueur made in Boston, which we enjoyed. We might work that into a cocktail. You like? Did you try that one, Stas? Yeah, it's good. And this is what I'm going to go out on. Bully Boy Rum, which is a Boston rum. And for those of you that don't know, Boston, Medford actually specifically, you know, if you're into the whole Medford thing, known back in the day, pre-Prohibition, for being a center of rum distillation since before the American Revolution. In fact, Paul Revere famously, as he's riding down the, you know, trying to warn, you know, I guess that the British were coming, although that's a bunch of hokum. There's actually, you know, Revere, like, got his horse taken from him, like, you know, like when he was in, I think, Lexington, got his horse taken from him and ended up sitting the rest of the night out, and it was another dude that that didn't get caught, you know, that escaped with his horse, that kept on riding out. The real freaking hero of the day, Paul Revere, you know, got caught, and yet they write the poem about Paul Revere, because I can't even remember the other guy's name, but apparently, you know, not so good for poetry, so Revere gets all the props. Right. But anyway, so on the way out to get captured by the British and not really warn very many people because he got captured, you know, fairly early on in the thing, he so I'm going to get some crap about that. I know I am. He takes a swill of Medford rum, which was supposedly pretty good. And you read about this in Wayne Curtis's book on rum. And they reenact that to this day. People will fake ride past there, and they'll take a swig of rum, but no longer from Medford. And I'm hoping that the Medford ride people are now using the Bully Boy rum. We enjoy it. Now, one last thing about Medford and Boston and rum. The Boston rum was produced from molasses, because guess what they can't grow in Boston? You guessed it, sugar cane. They can't grow it. So they would take the molasses and they would ship it up there, and so there were lots of stockpiles of molasses in Boston prior to Prohibition. And just prior to Prohibition, one of my favorite history crazy facts happened. The great molasses flood in the north end of Boston in 1919, just prior to Prohibition, even though it wasn't actually for rum that it was for industrial alcohol. So in 1919, a giant tank, like imagine, you know, those giant tanks of fuel that you see in Elizabeth, New Jersey, as you're driving down the turnpike, those big kind of fuel tank stars, you know what I'm talking about? Imagine it filled with molasses. All of a sudden, these people on the street, and there's like an elevated train, there's horses, there's all this, 1919. They hear bing, 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 boop, and all of a sudden, a 15-foot-high wall of molasses running 35 mile an hour, right? Exerting a pressure, according to one thing I read, of 2 tons per square foot, right? And just smacks into you. It knocked down like railroad cars, like horses just got in molasses. And like a bunch of people died. A bunch of horses died and a bunch of people died. And can you imagine anything worse? You're drowning in molasses. You get smacked down, tackled by molasses, and then you drown in molasses in Boston. And the story was that for decades, even into the 70s when I was a kid, which was when I first read about it in Smithsonian Magazine, I can remember to this day reading about it because one of my great aunts from Medford, well, you know, my stepfather had these like three maiden aunts who never got married. And they were born. Anyway, so I was like, they remembered it. They remembered it. Into the 70s, the streets of Boston, when it got hot out, still smelled like molasses in the area where the flood was. Cooking issues. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network.